So we were talking about Wikipedia. Let's move on to blogs. So the idea of blog is an old idea of having a sort of personal diary, except that with web technology you can make it personal but visible to anyone who wants to see it. So the picture on the right is one of the first blogs, which is hard to see, but a sequence of pictures that were taken by this person who was carrying a sort of video camera and was taking snapshots of where he was going, what he was doing. So the term blog, you know, is a contraction of web blog, and was the term was coined in 97, so as I was saying before, the web really became a tool used outside academia and starting in 94, so it came out very shortly afterwards. So unlike a wiki, a blog is in general edited by only one person. It's really a diary, so it's a sequence, a 10-day sequence of posts. So it's not multiple people sort of editing and re-editing or extending a document or set of documents. It's sequential. There's a bunch of comments, so because it's edited by one person, those who read the blog can be given the role of giving comments, but not editing the blog itself. And a blog by itself is not really community oriented. It's someone who wants to share his thoughts or his experiences. And so the use is very different than wikis. So it's more a medium of expression, really, than a way of building community or a way of sharing information. Now, what is interesting is the success of the blogging platforms that were created in the early 2000s, which happened at the same time as the dot-com bubble, where everybody was creating a startup company that was going to come up with a killer idea and make loads of money. And to me, this is really it's really the epitome of people wanting to be, if not famous, at least to exist. So you know Andy Warhol's statement about, everybody would have their 15 minutes of fame. I don't know everybody, but a lot of people apparently crave for being famous or recognized or and so I think the blogs were really a way for people to have a personal way to express themselves. And it's really the antinomy of Wikipedia, where Wikipedia, originally all the contributors were anonymous. It's only when they started having problems with people defacing pages and doing this kind of things that they, although you can still, I think, do anonymous edits on many pages, but they introduced authentication just as a control mechanism, not necessarily to assign authorship, even though once you have the data you can make those studies. The blog is really the opposite in that it starts with your name at the top and it's you, it's your presence on the online world. And what happens is, and that really what was the ground for creating the social networking sites like Facebook and others, and the blogs were seen as also a novel way of doing journalism. It's citizen journalism, where people were reporting things. And because of the ability to post comments, and also the ability that was put fairly early on for having the trackback information. So being able to know on your blog who is pointing to you, which, if you recall, is something that was explicitly not put in the web originally, where links are unidirectional. When you create a link, only the pointing page knows what it's pointing at. The pointing to pages doesn't know which pages are pointing to it. A bidirectional link is a link where when I link A to B, well, the link may be oriented from A to B, but B knows that A is pointing to it. And so, again, you have a situation here where something was added afterwards through, in a sense, complicated technical means to appropriate the technology in a way it was not designed first, it was designed for in the first place to be able to support direct link and trackback links. And by measuring how many people point to your page, you get an idea of, you know, your, if not fame, at least your, I don't know the word in English, your recognition on the web.
Impact.
Impact, yes. And so, certain blogs became really extremely well known and made the people writing those blogs very influential. And so it came to the point of having political impact. And the first case of this was in the US, where there was a whole set of discussions between among a set of blogs and lots of people pointing to them and referring to them and reading them intensely about something that was going on at the time in the House of Representatives in the US. And so it seems to me that here we have a case where it's really the individual appropriating finding new roles as individuals in this online world, not really with the goal of creating communities, although it does create communities of by the fact that people were linking to each other's blogs, and you have tools today that are actually used very heavily by political analysts to see whose blog is referring to whose blog, and so measure the influence of certain ideas through this network, social network between blogs. And so that progressively, as it developed, gave rise to this more general notion of social media, which is really an umbrella term, and as you look around, you find a set of definitions that are not always consistent. But to me, social media is really an umbrella term for all the tools that allow a community or groups of people, I guess I should have said here, that share content, create documents, share it in the sense of making it available, and comment on it. And this notion of, you know, who's creating what, sharing with whom, and commenting what, creates this network of dependencies or relationships. So this is true of forums and blogs and wikis, although as we've seen in different ways on wikis, and in Wikipedia, getting to the users is not something that is necessarily easy and supported by the system. But on blogs and forums, the identity of the users is important, even if it's a fake identity. And of course, when you turn to social networks or social bookmarking sites, this becomes even more important. And so the term social media here is to be distinguished from, contrasted with mass media, which is the press in general, with this notion that you have some organizations that have the authority to decide what is news and to push it onto everybody through newspapers, through TV channels, through radio stations. And so a lot of these blogs, of course, have this element of citizen journalism where people, if not report on facts, at least give their opinion on facts. And something that strikes me is over the past, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years, the news that you see on the mass media, newspapers, TV, and radio, has become a lot less fact-oriented.
if you go to the US, it's absolutely stunning. You don't read about facts anymore. You don't have, I mean, very few newspapers or give you the facts. They give you their opinion on the fact, what they think you should think of the facts. And I think this has been really pushed by the fact that every time you put out, you know, information, all these blogs sort of take it and give it their own spin. And I guess the newspapers were feeling like people were reading the blogs rather than the newspapers as a source of information. And I think there's something quite interesting and, in a sense, scary about the fact that people are more interested about what someone else that maybe they trust, think of something rather than making their own opinion. And I think this is one of the greatest danger about all this ecosystem of blogs and social networks and all that, is reputation and belonging to, you know, a specific community is seen as more important than independent thinking. And at the same time, all this reputation system is based on following someone's blog because you think, you know, he has the right opinion about everything. And I find that scary. I mean, I know when I'm in the US, where it's really, really quite extreme, I mean, people call themselves, kind of call each other names all the time. And if you have one opinion on one particular topic, you're immediately classified as you are either a liberal or a conservative. And, you know, if I have one opinion, I mean, I don't know, on gay marriage, that's something that's on the news here in France, you know, this opinion sort of classifies you, and if you think one way or the other on this issue, you might think this way or the other. The other on gun control, on, I don't know, on a bunch of other social issues. I think they hide.
You're not.
Yeah. No, I think it's becoming socially weird if you have, I mean, I don't know, if you're in favor of if you're in favor of gay marriage, you should be pro-choice and not pro-life, if you're in the US.
I had a serious conversation with that exactly going to gay marriage. I said something to a forum with some American friends that I think it should be done or something like that. And I had an answer like, are you communist?
No, exactly. I think it's really, you know, the internet in general and the web in particular has been absolutely amazing to open the eyes, you know, onto a world that you didn't know exists. To expose yourself to things, I mean, I'm not talking about YouTube here, for example, but, you know, you can find on sites like YouTube or on blogs or, you know, in Wikipedia, I mean, you have access to amazing diversity of things. And I think somehow this, I don't know if it scares people or if it makes them feel insecure. I know for myself, what I find is with the web now, every time you have an idea for doing something, someone else has done it 10 times bigger. And I find that it's very, how do you say that? It's very, I don't know, it hurts, you know, you think you have a good idea and then someone else has already done it. And it used to not be the case that you had access to this information. So if you wanted to do something yourself, well, you do it, you enjoy it. It doesn't matter if other people have done it. I mean, we're all unique already. We don't have to prove that we are better. I mean, the point is to enjoy life, not to... And so there's a researcher, and I have a slide about this at the end, Eli Reiser, Harrison is talking about the filter bubble. And I think the point is that in this world here, people tend to themselves filter information, decide which site they go to, which blog they read, which opinion they trust. But, as we will see in a moment, with recommender systems and all this personalization that is happening nowadays, where more and more information that is presented to you is customized to what the system is, your taste, your profile, your opinion. Which means that more and more, and that's true if you look at Google, if you look at many news sites, if you look at, Amazon, you are only exposed to stuff, to things that match your profile. So, to things that the system thinks you are going to like, so that you can buy them one way or the other, whether it's buying a product or advertising. And so this filter bubble means that, you know, we've gotten to this point of having access to very little information, to having access to a large amount of information, very diverse, to having access to the subset of this that he calls our bubble, things that has been designed by the system to be the stuff we want to see. And that's scary because he was showing even on things like Facebook that one day all of his Republican friends, he's a Democrat, all of his Republican friends disappeared from his social network on Facebook. Because the system decided that, you know, they were... they didn't match, so you shouldn't have to deal with it. So I think this is what is worrying me, because it's also happening in a way that you do not notice. I mean, you know, you do a Google search. Ask around, how many people, not your computer geeks, friends, you know, how many normal people realize that when they do a query in Google, they don't get the same result as if you do it or if their neighbor does it. People don't know that. But not even just Google, most news sites nowadays. When you go to an e-commerce site. And it's the fact that there is, you know, I'm fine that the system is trying to help me, and sometimes very useful. I mean, I'm often stunned by Amazon's recommendation system. It's pretty damn good. But I want to know what it is I'm missing. And that's what's the problem, I think. So I think with all this galaxy of social media sites, what you do is something that is, in a sense, really, to me, it's really against the notion of community. Even though at the same time what it's doing is aggregating people, but I think it's against the sense of community because it's aggregating people on its own without you making informed choices. You know, I make a choice to join a community and to see if I belong and if I can contribute. In this approach, the system is making decisions for me. It's classifying me as belonging here or there, and I don't have really a choice or even awareness that I've been classified in this way. So I find that worrisome. So that gets us to social networking sites. And I've been careful to call them social networking sites as opposed to social networks, because social networks, in my opinion, should be a word used for what it is, which is the graph depicting the social relationships among people. So when we talk about Facebook or other sites of that sort, it's sites that help people to create a social network. So, I mean, here we are pushing this one step beyond, because you're going to blogs where people, or forums where people express their opinion, and where the emphasis is put on the individual, to a site where you start by filling out the user profile that will be used by the system to help sort and classify information and decide what to show you and what not to show you, who should be your friend and who should be following you. And it's based on a very strong idea on the idea that is extremely strong for humans, which is that, you know, in a world of complexity and uncertainty, people tend to trust the people they know, sometimes more than they trust themselves. And every time you have to make a decision, making decisions is hard. And in fact, it's hard at the biological level. I was reading a fascinating article a couple of years back about, you know, when you go to a supermarket, there's all the junk they sell at the end, the sugary stuff, right? And people buy this. What happens is that when you're in a supermarket, you know, running your errands, you make choices all the time. You know, do I take this pasta or that pasta? Do I take this ice cream or that ice cream? And to make choices consumes energy. Your brain consumes energy. So by the time you get to the cashier, you're craving for sugar, and they stick sugar under your nose, and you buy it. Now, what this paper was reporting is on studies they did, that if you are a wealthy person, if you have money, when you go to the supermarket, it's a lot easier to make choices. You pick the produce that you like to buy, and you don't pay attention to how much it's going to cost. And so when you go to the cashier, you're not craving for sugar as much. You tend to not buy this crap. And you have a happier life. People who are on a very tight budget, and I have seen that in the US. I don't think I see it in France, but I see people in the US who everything they put, they look at the price and they, you know, they see if they can make it. I've seen people buying stamps by the unit because they don't have money to buy you know, a row of 10 stamps. So, I mean, it's quite striking. And so, you know, this is a people who are in a tight budget, so they have to make more choices and harder choices because they would like to get this, but it's too expensive, so they're taking that. So not only it's less good food in general, health-wise, but it costs them more, and when they get to the cashier and they make all this effort, they grab more food, which hurts their health even more. And I was reading recently that there are more people who reached the point worldwide where more people die of obesity and diseases that go with it than people dying of malnutrition, which is stunning and scary. But anyway, this doesn't have much to do with this. Sorry about this. So, getting back to social networks, social networking sites. So, yeah, people trust the people they know. And so this notion of friend is extremely powerful because, you know, people want to have friends because then they have access to their opinions more easily. And from the social network perspective, they allow them to gather the social network precisely more effectively, more explicitly, than when you look at blogs and who is citing whom. I mean, here's people who are my friend, and I'm proud of them enough to display them on my page. And it sort of enforces some aspects of human nature, which is, you know, vanity and social authority, and being recognized, and you know, how many people are proud on Twitter or Facebook of the number of followers they have, or friends, or whatever name they use. And it is something there is something very human about that. Of course, the bad thing is that it's used in ways that are not always in the best interest of the users themselves. And even though I think, you know, social networking is an extremely good idea, I think think there is something really wrong about the way all of these sites are run, because essentially their goal is to create silos of information that is, you know, either about the user or related to user preferences and all that. They trap it inside their site. Users don't control ownership of what they contribute to those sites. And the real goal is not to really foster collective intelligence. It's really to gather personal data to make money on the thing that is their real business, which is oftentimes to sell advertising. And the best sign of this is that those sites have no interest in interoperating with each other. And all the technologies that have really spread over the years are things that promote interoperability. That's why the web exists, because it was one protocol, it was simple for everyone to use and to implement, that unified a bunch of things that were completely disconnected before. And so now within this architecture, we create these social networking sites that are completely isolated from each other. And so, you know, your profile, I mean, yourself on Facebook is nothing to do with the one on LinkedIn or on Twitter. And in a sense, it's probably a good thing given what they do with their user data, but it's really not working towards this ideal of collective intelligence, because this is really not their goal, at least for the most part. I think I'm going to skip social navigation very quickly. It is this idea that relates to, you know, people don't like to make decisions themselves, and so they like, when they navigate a complex information space, they like to have sort of help, and one way to get help is to, you know, use the wisdom of the crowd in the sense of following what others have done when they were in the same situation. So, when you look at things on the web, you make judgments about the value that this information has to you based on the perceived value of what it had to others. So if you read a blog post and it has many comments, you think, oh, this must be something hot, so I better read it. So that's a form of social navigation, where you navigate in the world based on the traces left by others. And as I was saying before, this is now really the basis for many search engines. In fact, Google's PageRank, you know, the notion that the value of a page is measured by how many other pages reference this one, or how many pages this one references. You know, the number of pages of outside pages that reference a given page, it's a measure of how many other people have felt like this page was relevant. So it is, in fact, a form of social navigation in that sense. Okay, so I wanted to have a slide on social networks in the original meaning of the terms. When you create a social networking site, but also when you collect user data information, you can create a social network. And a social network is a particular type of graph where the individuals are the nodes of the graph, and you have edges in the graph if you have relationships. So it can be being the friend of, or the follower, or having commented on someone's blog or something like this. And one mathematical property that emerges from all of these networks is what's called being a small world network. And the idea of a small world network is that even though the graph is sparse, so there are very few connections compared to a full graph, so if you have n nodes, the full graph would have n square connections, while the small world network has many fewer than that. And yet, all the nodes are connected with a reasonably short path. So, in a sense, it's a very, like to say, energy efficient network, because you can reach every node from every other node with a fairly short path without paying the cost of having all the possible connections. And the way this happens is that you have nodes with large degrees connected to many other nodes. So it's a little bit like a tree. A tree is in fact a particular example of a smaller network. In the tree, if you want to go from one point to the other point, you just need to go to the common ancestor. And so it has very good properties, and it's an interesting structure that you find again and again when you look at all sorts of ways of mapping or extracting a graph from information from the web, from the social websites, from conversations, from email, from anything. Now I want to transition that to the last section of this, which is this idea of going from system that harness the collective intelligence of a group of people to mixed intelligence system where you have not only the human intelligence but also the computer quote intelligence at work. So in most of the systems I talked about, in all the systems I talked about until now, there was really nothing done by the system other than interconnecting the information, linking people together, transmitting information. The content was not particularly analyzed or processed by the system. Now, if you start analyzing the content of what people put on the web, what they exchange, then you get more dynamic media where you can combine the natural intelligence of humans who have put, you know, their knowledge and their skills into these documents or these communications, and the artificial intelligence that can process these contents. So I call this mixed intelligence. Well, first I called it hybrid intelligence, and then I discovered that hybrid intelligence is a word used in AI when you mix different AI techniques. And then I thought of mixed intelligence, which I kind of like, because it doesn't seem used too much already. But it's also, for me, parallel to what we call mixed reality, where you mix artificial virtual reality with real world. What's called mixed initiative dialogue, where you have systems, for example, that have agents, computer agents, where the initiative of action can come from the user, but also from the computer.
Oops, did I? Yeah.
So, quickly, two things here. Recommender systems. So, you know, of course, about Amazon recommendation or YouTube recommendation. So you go to a website, you look at some content, and the system tells you, well, if you like this, you should also like that. Where did that come from? Well, it's because the system analyzed what other people who have done things similar to you have also done that is not similar. So based on your profile, based on your history of navigation, on the things you've looked before, based on what Google calls various signals, it computes a rank list of other items that might be of interest to you. So essentially it combines two types of things that are called collaborative filtering and content-based filtering. So collaborative filtering uses historical data of users' activity, tracking what you've done before. And content-based filtering is using similarity between items, saying, so well, if you were looking at this, looking at that, these items are similar to these other ones, so you should look at those ones as well. So by crossing these two things, the first one allows you to fine-tune the profile for the user, and the second one allows you to navigate by proximity, by similarity inside the database. So the thing is that it's using the power of the crowd to provide the recommendations. So by not only looking at things, but in the case of Amazon or YouTube, it tracks whether you bought the product or because of YouTube, whether you actually watched the video or the whole video, things like this. So it can, you know, extract a human recommendation
And combined with data mining approaches, you can provide this kind of feedback. And it is very powerful, but at the same time, it is a bit scary because, as I said before, it will only show you things that you were expecting to see in the first place. It's scary for other reasons. I don't know if you know about the Netflix Prize, but Netflix is a company in the US that for a number of years was, it's a movie distribution company. So you could subscribe and have a DVD sent to you every week, and you watch the DVD and you return it. And then they moved to an online system, and it's used by millions and millions of people because watching TV in the US is impossible. There is more advertising than content, and so a lot of people prefer to pay to watch movies without ads in the middle. And so Netflix used a recommender system to say, well, you watch this movie in a movie, so you should like this one. And they put out a prize. They would pay $1 million to the person of the group who would create a recommender system that would be at least 10% more accurate than their recommender system. So accuracy here is saying, well, Netflix, recommend you watch this movie, how many people will actually watch it? If I can increase that by 10%, I get $1 million. And for this, they they put out a database, an anonymized database of comments by users with 100 million movie ratings by end users. And the database was anonymized. Now, in 2007, they had a system, the best system, which didn't win the prize, had over 100 different AI algorithms working together to try to beat the system. The winner was in 2009. They win the $1 million prize by showing an improvement of 10.06%. So they were right over the edge. Now the thing is, everything is becoming a hidden recommender system. Google, the PageRank algorithm, which created Google in the first place, is only, I think, less than 20% of the weight among hundreds of signals they use to decide whether this result is for you or not. And that's why they want to gather as much historical data, location data, anything that has to do with what you do, they want to collect. But the other way to look at this is that, it takes a lot of computer work to beat the crowd, in a sense, to improve over the wisdom of the crowd. Now, the reason I brought the Netflix prize we'll see that on the privacy issue. So, anyway, there is a dark side to that story that I will tell you in a second. Okay, so recommender systems, we combine data mining, machine learning, or we would rather apply it to data collected from users and by users. Now, crowdsourcing is a different twist on that idea of combining human intelligence and machine intelligence. And the term, in fact, was coined by a journalist from Wired called Jeff Poe in 2006. And it started off this ESP game by a student from CMU in 2005 about image tagging. Now, it's been a long time goal to have search engines on the web that can search images based on descriptions that you would give. And so for this to work, you need to tag all your images in your database with descriptors. And image analysis is still not very accurate today. And for a picture like this, recognizing that it's a chimney on a house with a sort of tree in the back is not that easy. Recognizing that there's a statue, I think, at the top is even harder. And so I created this game where over the web, you just click an image, shows the image to two users, and asked them to enter keywords to describe this image. So they have this little text box here. And they have to agree on a keyword for the system to keep it. So the thing is, they want to do this at large scale, so have a bunch of people, or when they have nothing else to do, to go on this site and say, you know, I'm going to help them by tagging some content. But of course, you want to eliminate the noise, people are going to just do random words or do stupid things. And so by having two users and having them to agree, you, I mean, of course, they could decide to play the game, but because it's done over the web, the people don't know each other, and the paper shows that, you know, you have really little noise with that. And so, solves a difficult, what did I write here?
Image.
Image recognition problem, thank you. Image recognition problems, yeah. So, the thing is that here using human intelligence, something we do, you know, without thinking. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of effort to look at a picture and say, oh, is it a car, is it a house, is it a person, etc. Tagging it. And once I have this, then I can do a search engine for images. Now, this has been done more recently, it's been quite out in the press, for protein folding, where they put out this program that you can download. And the goal is to take real proteins, because this is a big problem for biologists at the moment, where they have the sequences of DNA, but they don't know the 3D conformation of the protein. And that 3D conformation can be guessed by a bunch of fairly complex rules of, you know, what can twist and what cannot and this and that. And so again, they turn it into a game where people have to sort of, with a tool, create these diagrams here, following the rules. The system gives them feedback about, you know, where they're doing well, where they're doing bad. They have a score, and so you want to have the highest score. And in fact, you know, distributing this over the web and having zillions of people do it, they actually, there is at least one example of a protein where the crowd found a folding that was 100 times better for some measure to what they have, the scientists had figured out before. And I think that's interesting here because, well, first there's this gamification aspect that we see in many areas where people like to compete, so they want to have the highest score, they want to. So it helps recruit non-experts to participate in something like this. But what's interesting about this compared to the image game is that this required really some intense effort. Now, you know, there are many people who like to play Sudokus or do things just so, in a sense, it's using this kind of intelligence to solve real world problems. So, Amazon has in fact turned this into a product. It's called Amazon Turk, in reference to the Mechanical Turk. And you know what the Mechanical Turk is? Yeah, so it was in the 1800s, I think, that there was this chess player that was an automaton, that was a machine, presented as a machine. But in fact, inside the machine, there was a very good even player who was able, who was manipulating the chess pieces. So the Mechanical Turk was going around the world and making this demonstration of a chess machine who played better than most chess players. In fact, it was a human inside. So that's why Amazon called it the Mechanical Turk. That's why we call the people who use that system to contribute Turkers. And the way it works is you go on Mechanical Turk. You have, right now you have to be in the US because you need the US credit card. But that's the homepage of Mechanical Turk. And you can be a Turker, make money by working on human intelligence tasks. So you click here, you give in tasks that people have created for you. Or you want to actually solve a problem with human intelligence. So you create your task on that part. You have to put money in an account, you have to decide how many cents, usually it's not big money, you pay per individual task. And then Amazon takes care of the rest. You come back the next day and you have
results.
And it's used really fairly extensively, but it's used mostly for crowdsourcing really basic tasks like this image game we're doing, or essentially you know, comparing things, or fairly simple tasks. And in my opinion, there is a real problem with this approach, and even the systems like 99designs or Odesk, which have really become extreme temp agencies. Because 99designs is a website where you say, oh, I want a new logo for my company, or I want a business card, I want a design for my website. You make a description of your requirements on their website, then designers who have subscribed to the website are going to go, are going to work, put out a proposal, then you see the 10 or 20 or 100 responses you get, you pick the one you prefer, and that guy gets the money and the others work for nothing. If you're a Turk or a Mechanical Turk, the tasks are usually a couple of cents per task. And a large proportion of the users are people who are in India, in China, and developing countries who, in fact, do this night and day to make a living. And so, I really think we are close to a modern form of slavery here. Because, you know, people who work on these sites, they don't have a work contract, they don't have any social rights. Yes, they do it voluntarily, but for some, it's a source of real income. And I asked, I was attending a panel in San Francisco about crowdsourcing, and I asked the people on the panel, who were all researchers or companies working in this area, I said, have you ever spent a day in the skin of a Turker, doing this yourself for hours in a row? Like, we know a number of people do, and they didn't really want to answer the question. So we have something here that is a little bit of concern, because using this idea that contributing to this project like 3D folding or being able to if you are on the other side, to get a bunch of proposals for a new logo in a matter of hours. All this looks very good, but at the human level, in the back, it's not so good. There are some cool examples, though, I find, when you really make a smart combination of what the computer can do and what a user can do. So Soylent is a system built by Michael Bernstein, who's at MIT, is now at Stanford. And so this is a typical PhD student idea where you have to write papers, and when you write a paper it's to fit in 10 pages, and you always have 10 and a half pages, and it's 2 hours to the deadline, and you need to cut the last column of your paper. And so he built a text editor where instead of doing the shorting himself, he would put this out in Mechanical Turk and ask Turkers to take a piece of the text, or give them a piece of the text, and say, well, can you write so it means the same thing but shorter? And so Turkers do that, and then he's using a second set of Turkers to say, well, here is three different ways of shortening this paragraph, which one is the best? And then he takes the best result and he pastes that automatically inside his Word program. And even better than that, I was going to show the video, but we're out of time. You can find it there. I'll put it on the website as well. He even had a cursor to say, well, how much I want to shorten it. And in real time, once all the responses are back, you could see the result. And he built that, I'm sure he would build it with, but this was done in parallel by Greg Little at the same lab, where he created a programming language so you can program this thing. So you can program an algorithm where some of the tasks are human intelligence tasks that gets automatically outsourced to Mechanical Turk. And it's a very nice thing because it makes it so while you're testing your program, because as every program you have to debug it, but every time you're going to run your program, you don't want to have to pay for real people to do your tasks. So it's able to record the results of previous runs of the HITs,
when you run it again. And as long as you don't make too many changes and the results are reusable, you don't need to not only spend more money, but also wait for the results from the humans to come back. So you have an environment for really running, testing, and debugging programs with human interactive tasks. This area, I mean, I was at Stanford. The group I was in was mostly working on crowdsourcing approaches to web design, to various, to even to programming, to things like this. The lab at MIT is doing that a lot. You go to the CHI conference there. I can tell you because I know the program. There are sessions about this. So it's really a big thing at the moment. Now, I want to go quickly over these last three slides about risks and issues, because I've talked about some of them as we go. And crowdsourcing is certainly disconcerting, as I said, because on the one hand, it's a great idea to have ways to better combine. I mean, I think with crowdsourcing, we're going beyond really this notion of pure interaction, where you know there's a user, the computer, and the roles are well defined. I mean, here you get a different ways of mixing the two, which I find intellectually interesting. I also find challenging because of the social implications. So, quickly about the risks and issues on this various issues we talked about today. Privacy protection. So the dark side of the Netflix prize is that someone took the data that was anonymized from the Netflix prize. Not only was it anonymized, but they added noise in the dates at which the comments had been made. Despite that, someone created that information with information that is in IMDb, which is this database, sort of the Wikipedia of movies, where people put comments about movies and all that. By correlating this anonymized data from Netflix and the non-anonymous data from IMDb, they authenticated 90% of the authors. Which means that with the traces you leave behind you as you go around the web, and there has been other work more recently about this, it's very easy to identify who did what, even if they thought they did it anonymously. So, and I think there's no technical solution to this. Same thing with the data that you put out and that stays there forever. If we don't create laws that say people have the right to forget, they have the right to erase a stupid image that made it to Facebook, and companies have a duty to preserve the anonymity, and it should be a felony or something to correlate information to identify people. When people haven't authorized that kind of use. So the only solution to me has a legal element. It cannot be just technology. And it's the same thing for social hacking. I mean, nowadays it's a lot easier to go into a system by doing a social engineering attack than by trying to break the password. There was a case recently of a journalist, a famous website, whose laptop was wiped remotely because some hacker had been able to get his password just by calling people from Amazon and from Apple it was very cleverly done, but was able to convince the people he was talking to that he was the owner of the laptop, and they gave him his password, which they're not supposed to do, etc., etc. I mean, you know all the phishing attacks you get on the on the web, or email, need to reset your credit card. And originally it was, bank, so they were faking bank sites and this and that. Now it's sort of second level. I keep receiving the one for EDF, the electricity company. And I'm sure if I click, it will ask me for, my credit card number or something. So that's obviously a weak spot there. At the social level, there's this filter bubble that I talked about, so I'm not going to talk about it again, but here's the name of the guy. He has a very nice talk on TED Talks, if you want to go there. Try to remember to put a link. The net result is the social web tends to insulate these communities that are not communities created by the individuals, but decided by the system.
Another aspect is surveillance, which is a French word created on surveillance. So surveillance is when you have, you know, the police or government or control people by observing them and tracking what they do. Now the thing is, with all the systems we have, and particularly smartphones with cameras and people, you know, shooting everything they see, putting it up on YouTube, etc., you have this notion where we are, in fact, observed not by the power above us, but by people like us. And I don't get into this; it's pretty scary. But it's a real threat. And last one here is the economical aspects, which I also alluded to. So the second one here is this issue of workers' rights. When you actually do work on Mechanical Turk and Odesk or others, you're not considered really as doing work the same way as when you have a contract. And I think it's something that has to be sorted at some point. And then the other thing is this sort of twisted business models where, so this is a sentence I've find who put it out first, but you know, if you're not paying for something on the web, you're not the customer, you're the product being sold. So, you know, these days, if you go to Google, what interests Google is that by providing information on what you're looking for, it will give value to their advertising business. And so it's your personal data, your circle data and other that is sold, or that they used to make money from advertisers. And, you know, I would rather pay Google, I don't know, €5 a month, and not have all this crap going on. But, after, I don't know, 20 years, you know, 94, yeah, almost 20 years of being used to free stuff on the web, I don't think people would agree to that, but this business where everything is funded through advertising, so sort of behind your back, is killing the press. I mean, the newspapers are dying one after the other, and the websites, their websites, you know, if they put the paywall, try to make money, because the advertising revenue is much lower on the web for newspapers than it is on paper, well, they don't have enough customers to pay the bills, and so newspapers are disappearing one after the other. And I think here there's also a social, economical issue of how do you preserve some businesses if we think it's a good idea. And I think citizen journalism is great, but I don't think we can only rely on citizen journalism, because the facts are always often captured by real journalists in the first place. So these are big issues, and so I'm not pretending to have good solutions to this. Conclusion. So Bush, Licklider, Vannevar Bush, not George, Licklider, Engelbart, saw this notion of combining human skills with computer power to do things that would not be possible otherwise. So the state we're in, I think we've seen nothing yet. You know, I think it's the very beginning of, especially with approaches like crowdsourcing. And I think, even though those issues I mentioned here, technical, social, economical level, are pretty serious and difficult, in that there's not always an obvious answer. And even when there's an obvious answer, it's not easy to put in place. I think if you go one step even beyond that, it raises the question of what it is to be human. More and more of our cognitive abilities are being externalized. We don't need as much memory as we used to because everything is in Google. So at the same time, we rely more and more on this technology, of course, to do our everyday work. So, you know, what is the line between what we create, what the machine computes, and does it make sense to make a distinction? Or at least, how do we adjust our social rules?